I Eat Green with Bhavani Jaraf, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Everybody, and welcome to a wonderful, beautiful Wednesday. We finally might get a little snow, which would be nice since it is winter, but it has been a beautiful, beautiful day, and I'm so happy to be here with all of you for the next hour. I have another exciting show today. My guest will be Joan Gussow, and she is a longtime teacher at Columbia Teachers College in charge of the nutrition education program. And she lives, writes, and grows organic vegetables on the west bank of the Hudson River. And she is a food advocate and a longtime supporter of local food and eating well. And so I'm really excited to have her on, and I'll tell you more about her when we get to that part of the show. Right now I want to tell you a couple things that are going on in the New York area, which is where I am. And throughout the show, if you have any questions, you can always call in here. The studio number is 888-874-4888, and we'd love to hear from you. Right now, most of my energy, besides cooking all the time for my private clients, a lot of my energy is going to helping organize the Long Island Small Farm Summit. And this is the second such summit. Hopefully it will be an annual summit. And we have two great keynote speakers on board. One is Will Allen from Milwaukee, from Growing Power. And he will be with us, talking to us about urban agriculture and how he has changed the landscape of Milwaukee and brought food accessibility to the people that need it there, and also created and built a wonderful feeling of community around the gardens and the composting that he's doing, and has involved youth and community, and it's just amazing how he's transformed the landscape there. And the other wonderful speaker is Ann Cooper. She is also known as the Renegade Lunch Lady, and she has been fighting tirelessly to help improve the school lunch program on a national level. And right now she's working in Boulder, Colorado, transforming that school lunch program after successfully doing it in Berkeley. And before that, she did it out here on Long Island in Bridgehampton at the Ross School. So we're thrilled to have Ann with us for this event. And we also just confirmed Tom Chapin, who will do a children family concert from 5 to 6 on that day. And his new CD is called Give Peas a Chance. And it is such a great CD. Actually, he will be my guest next week, and we'll play a few of his songs. So check in with us next week as well. So also, last night there was a forum for Long Island Homegrown out on Long Island. That was, you know, that's a wonderful new grassroots organization. Whether you operate a farm stand or you distribute at a farmer's market, what they're trying to do is locate open space that is available for farming, find farmers that are looking to farm, and help grow some vegetables for communities and food pantries that would like to get more food into their area. So that's really a wonderful thing. And we're actually on March 31st having our first Long Island CSA fair, and that will take place at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. And that's going to be a coming together of all the CSAs on Long Island so that people can find out about what CSAs are around, which ones are local to them, the different ranges and costs, the different quantities of vegetables that they would get from each one. Some have half shares. Some half shares are half the amount of vegetables every week. Some half shares are the same amount of vegetables every other week. So it depends on what works for you and your family. But there's lots of different arrangements that CSAs have. Some include flowers, some include eggs. So come on down to the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington on March 31st and find out what that is all about. Next Wednesday, I will be recording my show from Albany. I am going up to the state capitol for the No Farms, No Food rally. And this is an opportunity for advocates from across the state to come together and tell our state legislators how important it is for us to preserve open land for farms, how to encourage funding for farmers, and how to help older farmers transition their farms to younger farmers. Because I believe half of the farms in New York State right now are run by people over 65, and we have a whole new generation coming on board. And the more we can get people to come on board and grow vegetables in a sustainable, organic manner, the better. And that's only going to happen if there's support and funding to help get these people started and help the transition happen. So will be buses from New York City. So if you are available, I'd love to see some of you on the bus with me or meet me up there in Albany. That's next Wednesday, February 15th at the state capitol. Also, Just Food is having their annual conference coming up. It's a two-day event, February 24th and 25th, and that takes place at the Food and Finance High School. So Just Food is a wonderful not-for-profit organization bringing together local food lovers and advocates, CSA members, community gardeners, urban and rural farmers, food professionals, all coming together for a two-day hands-on workshops, discussions, skill-building opportunities. So if you're interested in that, go to the Just Food website and sign up for that. There is also an organic turf and tree show at Farmingdale State University on February 29th, and a green roofing event, which is really exciting. And that is going to be part of the New York Botanical Gardens, but it will be in their Midtown Center, which is on 20 West 44th Street on March 1st from 6:15 to 9:15, and it's Grow Up Green Roof Farming. And come meet Annie Kovac for that and learn about, Annie Novak from the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm in Brooklyn and see how they're doing it there and learn about green roofs and whether or not your building is suitable for growing vegetables. Can you imagine if every building in New York City grew vegetables? It would just be so awesome. It's good on so many levels, from saving rainwater to heating the building to growing food. So there's so many reasons to go that way. So if you are interested in that, come on down for that. Also, the New York Restaurant Show, if any of you are food professionals or just have a love for that, that's at the Javits Center on March 4th. And that's pretty much it for right now, I think. Once Upon a Hearth, Nourishing Ourselves, Enriching Our Culture Through Food. That will be on Saturday, March 31st at the Winkler Center at the Waldorf School in Garden City. And that is a full-day event from 9 to 3 for teachers, parents, community leaders, artists, health practitioners, coming together to celebrate our food and our food culture and trying to bring some humanizing counterweight to the mainstream unconsciousness that most people have with their relationship with food. So we're trying to improve that. And that is also what will be taking place at the Long Island Small Farm Summit on April 14th. So save that date, Hofstra University, April 14th. We are also currently looking for sponsors for this event. So if anyone out there would like to help sponsor the Long Island Small Farm Summit or have a table, we will be having a trade show there as well as part of the event. So you can be in touch with me. My website is www.ieatgreen.com, or you can send it directly to me, Bhavani@ieatgreen.com. So, I want to invite Joan on, and I also had a recipe to share with you, but I don't seem to have it here with me. While I get it, actually, I would like to talk about what I saw in the New York Times today. One of the things I love about having my show on Wednesday is that the dining section comes out on Wednesdays, and so often there's really great articles in that. And today, on the front page of the dining section, was a big article about food for thought. And that's something that, you know, I talk about a lot with my clients, and when I talk to people in general about food and eating, and one of the reasons I also love slow food is because it is about food for thought. It's about taking the time in your day and taking the time to really taste your food when you're eating. You know, if you were to close your eyes and really pay attention to what you're eating and really try to taste the food, it's such a difference than the way most of us just gobble our food down and eat so quickly. And so it's really a wonderful thing to bring into more of the mainstream for people to think about. I call it the zen of eating. You know, take a bite, put your fork down, taste your food, take some time to really chew it, and enjoy it. And then take the next bite. And one, you eat slower, you savor your food, and you have opportunities to really enjoy the company that you're with as well. So that's really nice. So anyway, the recipe I would like to share with you is my curried butternut squash soup. And for this recipe, you need a 2-pound butternut squash, cut in half, seeds removed, 1 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon freshly ground pepper, 3 tablespoons olive oil, 1 tablespoon of Madras curry powder, or whatever kind of curry powder you have. There's so many different varieties. 3/4 cup of chopped onion, 1/2 cup of chopped carrots, 1/4 cup of chopped celery, 1/4 cup of minced ginger, 1 tablespoon of minced garlic, 4 1/2 cups vegetable stock, 2 tablespoons chopped cilantro leaves, 2 tablespoons butter, 3 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 1/2 teaspoon ground turmeric, and 8 sprigs of cilantro. And if you want to make this vegan, you can just cut out that butter very easily and add a little more olive oil if you need it. So you want to preheat the oven to 400 degrees, place the squash cut side up on parchment-lined pan, season with 1/2 teaspoon of salt and 1/4 teaspoon of pepper, and then turn the squash over so that the flat side is face down on the parchment paper, and bake that in the oven for about 50 minutes. You can also put a little bit of olive oil on the outside of the skin as well, just to keep it moist. And bake it for about 50 minutes, just till it is soft, and then you're going to let it cool, and when it's cool, scoop out the squash and just set that aside until we're ready to use it. In the meantime, in a medium saucepan over medium-high heat, add the other 2 tablespoons of olive oil, and then add the curry powder, and just toast the curry powder in that olive oil for about 30 seconds. Then add the onions, carrots, celery, ginger, and garlic, and saute that for a little while until it starts to caramelize, about 3 or 4 minutes. Then add the vegetable stock and the reserved squash at this time, and bring the stock to a boil. And if you don't have stock, you can use just water. You can use water and a high-quality organic bouillon cube would work as well. And then you reduce it to a simmer, and cook the soup for about 15 or 20 minutes until all the vegetables are soft. Then you can remove the soup from the heat, and you can process it with an immersion blender. Or you can take batches out and put it into the food processor, but one of those immersion blenders are really easy. You just go right into the pot with it and go, back and forth until it's all blended, and that's it. Season it with, salt or pepper if you'd like some more, and then you can add some chopped cilantro right before serving. And that is it. Really delicious. You can serve it with some croutons if you like. I've also seen cubes of paneer cheese added to this type of soup if you want to. But I don't think it needs any of that. I think it's just so good by itself. So that's the recipe. Enjoy it. So now I'd like to invite Joan on. As I said before, she has been the former chair of the Nutrition Education Program for Columbia Teachers College. She is a food advocate forever. She's, been doing it for a long time. She lives, writes, and grows organic vegetables on the west bank of the Hudson River. She's been teaching a nutrition ecology course at Columbia Teachers College, even though she's been retired. That's, one of her loves, so she keeps that up. And she's also served on the Food and Nutrition Board of the National Academy of Sciences. She's also been on the Food Advisory Committee for the FDA and the National Organic Standards Board. She's a longtime advocate of relocalizing the food system, and she is an author of many books, The Feeding Web, Issues in Nutritional Ecology, The Nutrition Debate, Chicken Little, Tomato Sauce and Agriculture, and This Organic Life, Confessions of a Suburban Homesteader. And her most recent book, which just came out last year in November 2010, I guess the year before, called Growing Older, A Chronicle of Death, Life, and Vegetables. So I'm very happy to have Joan with me today. Joan, you there?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Good. Well, I'm so happy you're able to join us. As I invited you before, I wish we could get you down to the Long Island Small Farm Summit, which is going to be a wonderful event, and you would just be so welcomed there.
Well, it's a bit of a travel for me since I'm in Rockland County.
I know. So how did you get involved in the food movement? Tell me a little bit about when did you first, know that our food system was so messed up?
Well, I mean, I didn't sort of get involved in the food movement. I sort of helped start the food movement, actually.
Mm-hmm.
When I came into the field of nutrition, I was already an environmentally concerned person.
Mm-hmm.
And was very concerned about world hunger and population. I'd read Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, which came out in the 70s, and or 60s, I guess. And I went into the field with curiosity about how to, and I had looked a lot at, my children were young, and I had looked at children's television, and I'd looked at all the advertising, and I was really shocked by the food supply. And I went into nutrition figuring I would learn about these things, and I found out the field didn't have anything to do with any of these things.
Right.
And so I just, I was fortunate enough because I'd written a book, so I had a sort of gold star on my forehead, and I was older. The person who ran the department immediately had me help someone teach a course, and the woman who was very compatible with my ideas, though she hadn't had any chance to do anything about it, kind of let me begin to sneak sessions into the course. The first one about food and population, I think, was the first thing I put in, and the next one was probably about the environment, food and the environment, or the environment and the food supply, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And she never got tenure, so she left, and I inherited the course, and so I kind of gradually evolved it into this course, which had to do with all the things that went to affect how much food we had to eat and what kind of food we had to eat. It was about limits, started with limits to growth and food and population, and then it went into the food supply and what our food supply was like, and then advertising and agriculture. Though the agriculture really came in when I began to teach later. I put my book in 1978 was kind of at a time when I was just beginning to push my way into seriously looking at agriculture. I looked at food production around the world, but I hadn't really looked at agriculture in
which
this country.
Which book were you talking about, The Feeding Web?
The Feeding Web, which came out in 78.
Mm-hmm.
And so initially, when I got into the field, I was controversial enough for a lot of reasons. I actually testified in front of Congress about food advertising to children, which made me kind of infamous immediately because I was still a student. And somebody wrote to my dean and said, what did I have, you know, what business did I have doing this? And he wrote back and said, I guess you haven't heard of academic freedom, which I really thought was wonderful. So I felt very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really talk about the things my course was about for a long time. I talked about the state of the U.S. food supply, and I talked about other things. And so I was quietly fomenting my own kind of revolution. And then I began finally to talk about, by the end of the feeding web, by the time I finished it, it was clear to me that people were really so indifferent and so unknowing about where their food came from. It was like so removed from them that I thought the only way, I really came into the idea of eating locally because it seemed to me the only way you could begin to attract people's attention to where their food was grown was if they could know a farmer, and they could only really know a farmer and begin to understand food production if farmers were in the area where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And they could only do that if they would buy those farmers' foods, and so that led me to say that we really had to begin to bring food growing back home again.
Mm-hmm.
And I started talking about that probably in 1979, something like that. And it was thought of as a very, very radical idea. When I would go out and give a speech, I would always have to start by like 30 minutes of explaining what a mess everything was in. And then I could finally turn around to saying, well, you see, there really isn't any choice. We really have to start thinking about this, because it was so utterly, utterly alien to the nutrition profession. I mean, we had all been brainwashed on the idea that things were steadily improving. We had more and more access. We could eat anything we wanted anytime year round, et cetera, et cetera. And meantime, since the end of World War II, the food industry had devoted itself to inventing these food products, which made more profit for less raw material. And the whole food system was changing without people really paying attention. It's kind of they were immersed in it, and so they didn't sort of notice. And I realized not too long ago that the reason I had probably noticed so intently was that I was just at the age where I went away to school, to college in 1946 and graduated in 1950. And when I went away to college, obviously the college was feeding me, and when I graduated I came to New York, where everybody ate from delis anyway. And it wasn't until I got married and had a child and moved to the country and went back to the supermarket, which I hadn't gone to since I had gone away to college in 46.
Mm-hmm.
And this was like 57.
Wow.
Uh-huh. And everything had changed. I mean, you know, there was these aisles and aisles of juice and imitation juice, and it was just astonishing to me. I mean, it's like it hit me so hard because I think I hadn't watched it happen slowly.
Uh-huh.
And I realized that this was just, these were just, you know, this wasn't really food. And it took me a long time to actually say that flat out, but, you know, that there was food products and not food.
Right. Right, just like when American cheese started becoming, you know, a mm-hmm. processed food food product, you know, it wasn't cheese anymore.
Yeah, well, there were things back. I mean, Kraft has been around for a long time, and they were making Kraft American cheese, which was not any great thing. Americans never had any great taste for cheese, but at least it was made out of milk and, I mean, cream and made into cheese. But, you know, the time came when they, you know, were using the remnants from other things and packing them together and calling it cheese spread and, you know, came out of a tube. And all the ways they found to use fragments of food and turn it into something that they could sell. And so we ended up with all these amazing products, and the rate of product proliferation was staggering. I mean, really, really staggering. The last statistics I was able to find, which I don't trust at all, but the last were 17,000 products a year.
I believe it.
But
I believe it, and then the amount of money that they spend on marketing those products.
Right, right. Because nobody's going to buy a blue cereal called Norman without being sold. You know, they have to tell. They have to know what it's for in the first place, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's amazing to realize how astonishingly things have changed. Not that there isn't a huge, huge propaganda machine out there that's I mean, the fact that this local food movement is effective is evidenced by the fact that there's a huge propaganda machine mounted against it now. But we are in a place where nobody's ever been before. I mean, we are really a long way from where we were in 1970, maybe when I, 78, maybe when I started talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
A long way. It's very encouraging. If we move fast enough, not so the world won't fall right out from under us before we get there.
Right, you've been talking to Bill McKibben.
Right.
I know. Well, I'm right there with you. I mean, I went away to college in 75, and as a vegetarian, you know, I became a vegetarian after reading Francis Moore Lappe's book, and it was also because of the food population and, you know, and just wanting to get enough food to people. And, you know, so anyway, when I went to college, the vegetarian meal plan was non-existent, really. It was frozen broccoli with melted cheese on top and the same thing day after day, and it was horrible. And that's how I first got into cooking, because I, you know, was taking a look at this, and there was no way I could do that for 4 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And had to start cooking. And so the next thing I know, I was cooking for the vegetarian meal plan as part of my work study up at school, and they would get me anything I needed. It really, you know, was pretty great for back then. But it's so encouraging, as you said, to see how the food movement is starting to take off and people are starting to pay attention. But there's still so much more we have to do. And like you said, there's still such propaganda against it that we really have to fight. Did you see the article in the New York Times today about the farmers from, you know, not really Occupy Wall Street, but down in Foley Square, they came together about the lawsuit that the farmers are...
Oh, yes. Actually, I wrote a comment that was read there. I couldn't go in. I wanted to go in, but I couldn't. So I wrote a comment, and one of the organizers read it.
Oh, great.
About that, because I felt very strongly. I don't know. The judge, I don't has not handed down any answer, but any decision. But I read the whole case. It was online, and it was interesting that the judge.
Do you want to share a little bit so that some of my listeners who don't know about it can know about it?
Well, it's Monsanto as the sort of controller of a huge percent of the seed that's now planted in the United States, of corn and soybeans particularly, has been suing farmers. The pollen from these plants, particularly corn, is very promiscuous, and it flies around. And so farmers have ended up with corn in their fields or soybeans in their fields or rape seed, I can't think of what it's called, the other...
Canola.
In their fields, which they didn't plant there, which is Roundup resistant, which is resistant to being sprayed with pesticide herbicides,
right,
which is how Monsanto has engineered their crop.
Uh-huh.
And so they go through their field, and there are these tall plants that don't belong there. And I don't know the facts in all the cases at all. I mean, I know about Piercy Smizer in Canada, but the rest of the, I mean, what Monsanto does is it sues the farmers, and then the farmers, if they settle, have to agree not to talk about it.
Right.
So we don't know anything about it, just like we don't know anything about the safety of these foods, because Monsanto won't give the raw materials to the researchers to do the research. So we don't know about this, but the impression we all have, including these farmers who brought this suit, is that if a farmer finds this material on his field that he has not put there, he'll be accused of having Monsanto's, because that's what happened with this farmer in Canada.
Right.
The judge said it didn't matter whether it got there inadvertently or not. The fact is he had it there, and therefore he had violated their patent.
Right, right.
And so he lost the case. And so farmers rightly are very concerned about that. And so they brought a suit saying they wanted to be assured that if they did not contract to plant Monsanto seed or did not plant Monsanto seed, they would not be sued. I mean,
right.
I think that was really the essence of the suit,
uh-huh,
to my understanding.
I'd love to see them take it further and sue Monsanto for corruption.
Well, they should sue to
damaging
prevent
damaging their fields.
Yeah, they should actually bring a case and try to reverse the whole fact that you can patent seeds, because they haven't done anything. I mean, what's really so sinister about them and so dishonest about them is they write, is they claim when they're making a patent that this is brand new. This is because that's the only way you can get a patent, is that you've done something that nature hasn't done, and so what you've done is new. And when they go out and talk to consumers about it, they say, oh, it's, we've been doing biotech all these years. We've always had, you know, we've always raised bread, and we've always made beer, and we've always had these yeasts that we used for these. But, you know, you can't have it both ways. It cannot both be totally original and totally conventional. And that's what they're trying to say. It is completely, it's completely novel what they've done, which is to put a completely novel gene in, but they're not making anything.
Right, right. And you used to not be allowed to patent something that was life itself. It's only because of the connections that, that Monsanto has with the people in power that they're able to get a patent like that through.
Well, when they first got the patent, I don't think that happened at the beginning. I think the Chakrabarty case, where they were allowed to patent it, was before there was any industrial biotech. So it was just one of those stupid cases where somebody doesn't understand, if I may say, a little bit like the Citizens United case, where the judges seem to have their heads in the sand,
mm-hmm.
and where you get decisions that have huge, huge implications, and things go downhill from there. Anyway, the farmers were down there because Monsanto countersued and said that the case should be totally dismissed, that it had no, there were no grounds for a suit, that they had no intention of suing any of these people. They were totally, they had never threatened to sue any of these people. None of these people had been threatened. They wouldn't be threatened, et cetera, et cetera. And so how could the judge allow the case to go forward? So the farmers were down there, and they didn't let many people inside the courtroom.
Right.
So a lot of them gathered outside. And I read a statement saying, I mean, I wrote a statement saying that it should be allowed to go forward, obviously, because this should all be stopped. There are so many terrible things going on out there in the field, so I got to tell you. I mean, I'm very, very concerned. Years and years ago when this was all starting, I'm sorry my voice sounds so funny, I got something in my throat, but when this was all starting, Fred Kirschman and I were someplace at a meeting together, and we were sitting in the airport, and I said, Fred, what's going to stop them? This was probably 15 years ago, and he mm-hmm. said to me, well, Joan, nature will stop them. We just have to hope she'll be kind.
Right.
And
well,
she
I think a little bit that is happening when we see these super weeds.
Oh, yeah, and the other thing is that I don't know how much you know about this letter that was sent to Vilsack by a Purdue soil scientist saying that there were these awful things going on out in the fields.
No, what does the letter say?
He wrote a letter in January of 2011 to Vilsack, saying that he's a soil scientist at Purdue, and he retired emeritus. They're the only people who speak out. You've noticed that the only people who speak out against biotech are retired,
right?
Because they don't dare, because they'll lose their jobs, because
right.
That's what's happened. Anyway, he wrote a letter because Vilsack was considering whether to approve biotech alfalfa, Roundup Ready alfalfa.
And so he did approve it.
Yeah, but he wrote this letter first
uh-huh.
saying, look, we've been finding these problems with animals, and we've been finding these for a long time. Dairy cattle, to the level of 85% of a dairy herd, cannot get pregnant or abort. And when you have a dairy farm where the cattle can't get pregnant, you're finished. You don't have a dairy industry because you can't do it with that level of infertility.
Mm-hmm.
And when they began to try to investigate what was going on, they found out that the cattle had this, there was this organism that they were finding that they were unfamiliar with in all these cattle. And it was totally an unfamiliar organism. They still haven't been able to totally characterize it. It's the size of a virus. It doesn't behave like a virus because it doesn't require another cell to grow in. It can multiply on its own, but it multiplies much better in company with other bacteria and things. It doesn't do as well in a test tube by itself. Anyway, they've characterized it. They've put it back into the animals. They've done Koch's hypothesis and proved that it really is the infectious agent. And so they wanted to find out where it was coming from. And they looked at the cattle feed, and they found out that corn and soy that had been we're biotech, we're Roundup Ready corn and soy, which all of it is practically now. It's all you can get. Had the heavy loads of this organism in them. And so they're now trying to characterize it. They're trying to find out what it is exactly. They're having a hard time because it's very small and it's very difficult apparently to characterize because it's, as he said in one tape I saw of him, it's old in nature but new to man. It's not like it's a new organism. It's just that we don't know anything about most of what's in the soil.
Right, right.
Anyway, he sent a letter to the ILSAC saying, so please don't approve biotech alfalfa, because if this gets into alfalfa, that's the end of the dairy industry. And the ILSAC went ahead and approved it.
Right.
And
chickens, too. I mean, chickens all eat alfalfa.
The letter got, it's the principal forage crop for animals, so it's like, it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And the ILSAC approved it. The letter got leaked, not by Huber, who's the scientist, but apparently by Vilsack's office, because they knew if it got leaked, then you'd get all these countercharges, Purdue rejecting him and saying, well, their letter denying it is so hysterical. It's so transparent that they can't really say anything. They evidence that there is large scale such and such is lacking. Well, of course it is, because nobody's looked for it, right? So anyway, he's gone on the road a bit, although he's a scientist, and he's not really comfortable in this role, frankly. You know, it's obvious that he's not. But he's been interviewed by a few people. There are a few tapes online you can find if you look up Huber. Don Huber is his name.
And it's being
suppressed. I mean, you know, it's not like it's become a big public story. But it's, to me, I mean, it's very obvious that if you do something that suppresses... I should go on and say that I've now read a lot of the material, the backup material, and a lot of the papers that were published before this all came out. And it turns out that glyphosate is a very strong binder of trace minerals. And there's long been evidence that manganese deficiency occurs in plants that are exposed to a lot of glyphosate. And a lot of other mineral deficiencies, and they're now getting crop diseases, which are apparently related to the change in the soil organisms. You put that level of glyphosate that we use in this country now, and heavier levels now that they're getting these resistant weeds, and you put that much on the soil, and you're going to kill off a whole lot of the soil organisms. You don't know which ones. And you don't know what's going to come to take their place, because that's the way the soil works. I mean, you suppress one population, another population multiplies. So we're just playing with fire. That's all. We're just toying around with the soil organisms, which are what keep the soil fertile and keep plants growing and keep animals healthy and us healthy and everybody else. And we're acting like somehow it's a Lego toy, and we take out a piece and put in a different piece, and everything's just fine.
Right.
So it's very ominous to me. I mean, you know, I think nature is fighting back. It's just that most of us are not in a position to see the effects. I'm sure there are farmers out there that are scared to death. But they don't know what to do. I mean, what are they going to do? They've cropped this way. They don't have the machinery anymore to crop without, you know, they don't have to cultivate to get rid of weeds. They've been, you know, if someone said you can farm with no education at all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sow your crop with and then you can, when it comes up and looks great, you can spray it with weed killer.
And
I
feel bad for the farmer. They were like in the middle.
They're trapped. They're totally
trapped.
Yeah,
they were sold something that wasn't real by people that just wanted to make money on them, and they are stuck, you know. And so I always feel bad when, you know, people in the food movement are blaming the agri-farmers, you know. They bought into the system because that's what they were told to do. And
I think it's in Food Inc., isn't it? Or the other one?
Fresh. I think it touches on both of them, but Food Inc. certainly has a lot of it.
But with it, who has the Midwest farmer who's talking and explaining why he can't get out of doing soybeans the way he does it? No, I think it's in the other one, Fresh,
yeah,
where he's explaining that that he's very unhappy with what's happening with his soybean crop, but he's just trapped in the system that he has because he can't get out of it.
Right, right. It's sad. Anyway, we're going to take a few-minute break, and when we come back, I actually want to talk about your garden at home, because I saw some before and after pictures, and I hear you got hit really bad, so I would love to talk about how you came back from that.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Joan Gussow, author and food activist. And we're talking about our local food movement, how the movement has grown, and how she has been a big starter in bringing this movement to be. And her garden at home was hit really hard last year by the hurricane. And Joan, are you there?
Yep.
So when I went on your website, I saw pictures of your garden before and after, and it was just amazing how devastated your garden was. I mean, it was totally demolished. And then your after pictures it was back and beautiful. How'd you do it?
Well, with great effort.
I can imagine.
That was in 2010. Actually, it wasn't last year.
Okay.
It was 2 years ago. Well, I mean, it was 2010, so we're just into 2012. But it was the March of that year, and we had this horrendous storm, and it tore up my boardwalk, tore up all my raised beds, and piled them in the middle of the path. And I live on the banks of the Hudson, and my garden was basically a bathtub. That is, the riverbank was high, my house was high, and both sides were high, and in the middle was really sunken, so there was no drainage from it. And so when the water came in, and it did not infrequently from either heavy rains or from the water leaking from the yard next door, which was higher, it would get in and stay. In other words, it just sat in my yard. And so when this happened, it was so appalling. I knew that what I should do was to fill it in, that I should raise it all, but it was such an appalling idea. Well, after this happened, there was nothing left to be appalled about. So I just decided I had this astonishing opportunity because the house, there was no access to my yard. I couldn't have brought dirt in, because on the south side of me there was a park and a community garden and just my driveway, and we would have had to wheelbarrow the dirt in, which given the amount I needed was not feasible. I needed like 200 yards of soil, you know. So on the north of me, the house had been torn down and there was an empty lot. The guy hadn't started building the house at that time, and so we got permission to use it as a sort of staging area and came in that way and brought in 200 yards of fill, basically.
Oh, my God.
But that meant that the garden is separated into beds by pavers and bricks, and there were probably 1,000 bricks and, 200, 500, 300 pavers and all the plants, all the perennial plants, and a lot of garlic that I'd already planted that I had to do. Everything that was in the yard had to come up. Everything had to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And be put someplace, and since it's a small yard, so I mean it's 36 feet wide, and it's the garden took most of it, so most of it had to be filled. So I had to find places. I put it out next to my driveway, and I put it up on the porch, and I had everything in pots, and it was huge amount of work to get it sort of ready to be filled, and then it flooded again. And then when it finally dried out enough, Dave started bringing in, I found this guy, and he brought in this soil, and he scraped off all my topsoil to start with and used it over the top of the stuff he was bringing in, which was pretty bad stuff. And unfortunately, in parts of the yard, that's the topsoil is like 2 inches thick, and then the rest of it is this clay. So digging in it, when I started replanting again, I found that it was taking hours to put in a single plant, so it was really exhausting. It was amazing. I mean, I was not a young person at that point. I'm still not a young person. And I was working flat out 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
And so I learned to come in at four-hour intervals and take an hour flat on my back. That helped just to get gravity off of me. And so I was really putting in 12-hour days. And it got mostly replanted, and it was changed a lot because a lot of evergreens that had filled in one part of the yard were ripped out and just disposed of because there was no way to replant them. I mean, it was very hard to get a lot of stuff that was old up and get it back. My fruit trees were taken up and put back. I only had three anyway, and one of them has not survived. I'm going to do a new pair this spring because my old one just was so deeply, its roots were so deeply enmeshed with the roots of the maple tree, which sits up here in the front end of my yard, that when he took it up, it was bare-rooted, and he couldn't get it up any other way,
right.
And so it never recovered. But everything else came back amazingly, and when I reached the point where everything was sort of laid out and I was ready to start, McEnroe Farms sent me 20 yards of unbelievably beautiful topsoil, and that was going to get spread where the garden beds were going to be. And then Dave had that already, and I had Irene Hamber over here, who's a friend of mine who runs Stone Barns. I mean, runs Blue Hill at Stone Barns. And she said, Joan, could you use a really well-trained group of workers?
Mm-hmm.
I said, Irene, yes. And so 19 people from Stone Barns, Blue Hill, came over and laid all the beds for me in one day, which was really...
Isn't that amazing?
Put down all the pavers and all the bricks. And then they came in with 3 bags of compost for every one of the beds. So they were all covered. Each of them got a dose of that on top of the McEnroe topsoil. So the soil in the beds is not bad. It's not what it was. I mean, it's nothing, you know, it takes a long while to get your soil in the kind of shape you want it in. But basically, it got put back together again. And the boardwalk got rebuilt and the riverbank, and everything was now level. So it's 2 feet higher than it was. And it's hard even for me to realize it. People see it and say, well, what did you do? Somebody came from the garden next door and said, well, Joan, I see that you what did you do that's going to help? I said, this is 2 feet higher. Don't you realize this is 2 feet higher?
Mm-hmm.
However, it does not stop the river, and things are getting higher. And so this last year, I had 4.5 feet of water in my yard in that huge storm that took out all the farms upstate.
Mm-hmm.
And because of what I'd done, it was here at 9 and it was gone at 12. I mean, it didn't sit here forever. Like, I mean, had that happened the year before, it would have sat in the yard forever.
Mm-hmm.
But it went back out again. But unfortunately, when it came in, it brought 26 logs that required 2 people to move and 4 logs too big for people that had to be cut up. And there was a 2-foot in diameter, 20-foot log on the boardwalk. I looked out and I said, what in hell is that out there? And I went out and looked at the biggest log I've ever seen in my entire life. It was like a giant tree lying on my boardwalk.
Unbelievable.
So it all got, you know, I hired people to cut up the things and people came and helped and I did my usual overdo and I brought it back. Unfortunately, the person who built the house on that land that was formerly vacant north of me has put in probably the ugliest house I've ever seen. I really hope he's listening to this, though he won't be. And he also took down a chain link fence, which was on the back side of my fence, and was holding my fence up. And so my fence on that side, half the fence, which was held up by that chain link and not by post, came down into my yard when the storm came, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't, he won't even answer my letters. I mean,
yeah, and a lot of times when people come next door and they do that, they also mess with the whole drainage.
Well, he didn't wreck that. I mean,
no.
I'm still higher than him, so that's okay. But, I mean, because I had changed the level here, so I'm higher than him most of the places. But that's not the problem. The problem is just that he won't fix the fence, and I can't afford to do it right now. And so I'm very unhappy about that. And so I'm going to do it and sue him, I think. But it's very unpleasant, not the sort of thing I really want to do.
Spend time doing, yeah.
I want to do my own garden.
I tell you, you know, I have a, you know, small garden here. Well, not small, small when I see big farms, but it's a pretty large garden, and I just have such an appreciation for what it takes to grow your vegetables and the commitment and the daily, you know, task that that one has to put forth to make it happen. And so whenever I get a group of people to do it and you get a lot done in one day, it's just so wonderful. You know,
it's
really great when people partner together, you know, almost like a barn raising. And that's what it sounds like happened, you know, when...
Well, that rebuilding of the beds was a wonderful gesture, and I've never forgotten it. It's really, I appreciate it every time I see those people. They're lovely. And the people who didn't get to come miss it. They say, oh, I hope we can do something like that again. It turned out a lot of them had never worked together.
Well, you can send them
that way before.
A
lot of them were people from the restaurant, and the others were people from Stone Barns, and they don't really tend to get together and work, and they all had such a good time. They really enjoyed it.
Yep.
So it was fun.
You know, I've been involved in a community garden out on Long Island as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when people come together and work and get their hands in the dirt, the feelings of community that come from that, of
mm-hmm.
really doing good, wholesome work and working together, those kind of opportunities don't happen enough in our society anymore.
Mm.
And they're so nurturing. They're so nurturing, and they're really, you know, one of the things that I had on my website, you know, for people to go to is actually a horticulture therapy forum that's taking place. And, you know, the idea that, you know, you can work in the garden and be therapy. I mean, right, Alice Waters had the jail project going, you know, and, like, you get people out into the field.
Right.
And, you know, and they a lot of their aggression and, you know, their frustrations and whatever can be worked out right in the garden.
Yeah, well, I'm a great believer that people are going to have to come to terms with that, because if we don't, we're going to kill nature, and she's in charge.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, before we run out of time, I have another question for you. Last month, the Obama administration announced, you know, its new school meal nutrition standards,
mm-hmm.
And they are requiring school districts to double the amount of fruits and vegetables that they're serving in school cafeterias over the next 2 years, and then whole grains as well. They have to start serving half of the grain products have to be whole grain, and by the year 2014, all grain products should be whole grain.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're not funding any of these new mandates. They never do. They just give you the mandate, and they don't fund them. And they're also requiring all the milk to be fat-free, low-fat or fat-free instead of whole milk. How do you feel about these things? Do you agree with these standards?
I have not. One of the blessings of retiring is you don't have to pay attention to these things that happen. and I have not. I have not paid attention to the recent standards, so I don't know exactly what they are.
Okay.
I myself drink fat-free milk, but I have very mixed feelings about whether we ought to be having nothing. I mean, Elliot Goldman is very funny on this subject. You know, he's irate on this subject. He really can't believe it because, you know, milk is milk, and it comes with fat, and the idea that you take the fat off is anathema to him. I'm not sure that I agree.
And I had Sally Fallon on last week from the West.
I'm sure I know what she thinks.
and she also, you know, thinks that it should be, if it comes whole milk, that the fat helps the milk go through your body, and that it's, you get the full effect of benefits from it, if there is a benefit from it, depending which school of thought you're in. But anyway, we are out of time. I could keep going on, but we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So much, and I hope I get to see you again soon.
Okay, and good luck with your conference.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Take care. Bye. Everybody, you've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I've been talking with Joan Gussow, author and food activist, and one like the mother, the matriarch of the local food system. And so it's been wonderful. I hope you all have a wonderful week, and I look forward to seeing you next week. From Albany, no farms, no food. Hope you get up there with me. Okay, have a great week.